Welcome to Christ in Every Word, a weekly podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute housed on the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity every week to read, mark, learn, and take to heart the sacred scriptures with Dr. John Seleska, director of the Concordia Bible Institute, and me, your host and fellow learner, Dr. John Oberdeck, professor of theology and coordinator of lay studies here at CUW. We have been going through the book of Genesis. And it's been taking us some time because we've been doing it in depth, haven't we, John?
We have been doing it in very much depth, as a matter of fact.
Yes, we have. We have not left many stones unturned as we've gone through these chapters. And today it brings us to chapter 36, which, if you happen to be following along in your own Bible, you'll notice is filled with many unpronounceables.
Yes.
Name after name after name.
Very many names. And just to lead into it, a couple of verses again are thoughts from chapter 35, that sordid event in which Reuben lay with, I don't know exactly how to call her, the handmaid of his father, Bilhah. And it would eventually affect his receiving the birthright when the time came for the birthright and the blessings to be spoken by Jacob. So this would have dramatic effect on his future, really. Then at the end of this chapter, Jacob and Esau are brought together again at the death of their father Isaac, who was gathered to his people, and we take that to mean he simply went to be with those who are in glory, with the saints in glory, we would say.
Isn't that a comforting way to describe
it
one's
is. It's
death?
It is. A beautiful way.
Yes, it is.
I'll go to be with my people. And when we think of that, we think of all our loved ones who have gone ahead and whom we will see when that time comes. I do believe there are some people who believe we won't recognize one another in heaven, but I'm not one of those, again, who believes that. I do think we will recognize one another because, like with Moses and Elijah, who appeared to Christ, they were recognizable after their death. And so it's my thought that that will be the same, will be true of us.
Yes.
Yeah. Now then, in chapter 36, yes, there are many, many names there. This is really Esau's genealogy. And we won't try to go into all the names, but a couple of thoughts there are very important. In chapter 36, verse 6, it talks about the fact that evidently both Jacob and Esau were living together in the land of Canaan. And now that Jacob has returned with his household and his cattle and all his goods, and he takes up residence in this place which was promised to him, Esau leaves, interestingly. And it does say this in verse 7, I believe it is, that the riches of the two of them, the King James uses that word, by the way, the riches of the two of them were so great that the land really couldn't contain both of them. That is, the fields were simply being stripped dry, I suppose. There was not enough plant life and not enough grain for both of them. And so Esau decides to leave. And he goes to Mount Seir, and this will now be the territory of Esau, who, it says, is the father of the Edomites. And from henceforth we'll refer to them as Edomites, but they are the descendants of Esau, related to Jacob. A few other things about the Edomites. They play a part in Israel's history in a number of ways, in not only the Old Testament, but evidently in the New Testament also. They're in Isaiah, in Ezekiel, and especially in Obadiah. They're castigated for what they did to their brother Jacob, when in this instance, in 586, when the Israelites were being carried into the Babylonian captivity, they mocked at them. And as a matter of fact, evidently they picked up some of those who were leaving, trying to flee, and turned them into the Babylonians, so they were probably allied in some way, with the Babylonians. But interestingly, the Babylonians then turned on them. And Obadiah does make this kind of statement and prophecy before that happens. And he says, "How are you really going to be brought down, O you that dwell in the cliffs of the rocks, whose habitation is high? Though you exalt yourself with the eagles, and though you make your nest with the stars, I'll bring you down from there. So they thought that where they lived would, in these cliffs and in the rocks, that that would somehow be sort of an impregnable fortress. Well, it was not for the Babylonians, who swarmed in and simply brought them down and destroyed them. Those predictions by Isaiah and Ezekiel both coming true then. Why? Because of verse 10, I think it is, of Obadiah, which says, because of your violence against your brother Jacob. And then it goes on to describe some of the things which the Edomites had done when the Israelites were being taken captive into the Babylonian captivity. There are some statements that have been made in Deuteronomy. There is a statement, and I think it's verse 23, which says that you are not to abhor the Edomite. He is your brother. That statement is made to the Israelites. And then in 2 Kings, I believe it's chapter 8, where there is a revolt by the Edomites during the time of the divided kingdom. That particular thought, I think, needs to be included in the history of the two nations, that they did not always get along as they are here initially when Esau leaves to go to Mount Seir. And then interestingly in the New Testament, and I think this is Mark chapter 3, where it says, I believe verse 8, where it says that after Jesus had healed the man of the withered hand, that there were multitudes that followed him from Tyre and Sidon and from other places, and it mentions Idumea. Now, that's the Greek spelling, I believe, or the Greek word for Edomite. And we aren't told this in the scriptures, but Josephus does say in the Antiquities that he was an Edomite, that Herod, the king at the time of Christ's birth in Matthew chapter 2, that Herod who finally tried to destroy this king, that he was an Edomite, which is interesting because it means that he may have known that prophecy. And Balaam made a prophecy in Numbers chapter 24 about a star out of Jacob and a scepter out of Israel. And he would rise and he would, of course, conquer the Edomites. Well, I wonder if Herod didn't know that and say, well, it'll be over my dead body, and that's why he made that attempt to get at this king. Now, that's all trying to weave together the two histories, and it does, of course, depend on that statement by Josephus, which is, I think, dependable, although it's not scriptural.
Well, this is just fascinating when we think about the impact of this brotherly relationship between Jacob and Esau through the centuries.
Yes, it is.
It just doesn't have an effect on their own lives. You see this ripple effect through history, as the names resurface now and again, and in very significant ways and places.
Yeah, they're brothers and they're twins, of course, fraternal twins, but nevertheless, it isn't as if Edom is going to disappear from sight at any point simply because Jacob now becomes the heir apparent to everything, including that promise and the seed of the woman, the Messiah. But he's still tagging along.
We think today of the degree of animosity and conflict between the Jewish state and the Arabs. Now, is the lineage of the Arab, the Arabians, tied at all to Esau?
Well, I'm sure it must be. Huh? I mean, certainly those people are there somewhere.
Uh-huh.
All those people, the Ishmaelites, for instance, were children of Abraham, and all of them somehow, I suppose, flow together and are combined into what we today
call. That's where the major split comes in terms of Islam and Christianity.
I
as we look at it, it's back at Ishmael. It's not with Esau.
Although Esau certainly is intertwined here in some way, they aren't, I don't think, lost from history, although we couldn't possibly follow any thread through to discover, in fact, certainly, with any amount of certainty, that this includes the Edomites. But I can't imagine that they just passed away out of history completely.
Especially if, in fact, Herod was an Edomian and an Edomite, therefore. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a pretty powerful group of people at that time.
Right, still there.
Yeah.
Still around. And so still makes sense, at least, to include them, I think, in all of those people who are today no longer connected in any direct familial way. Okay. Now then,
are there other specific individuals in this long list of names that show up that really require our attention?
I can't think of any. I think that last verse, of course, does just simply say that Esau was the father of the Edomites, and it ends it with that kind of thought. But in going through, if we were to trace some of those names later on into the history of Israel, oh, by the way, there is one that we should really mention here, 1 Samuel chapters 21 and 22. Our listeners perhaps will recall that David was fleeing from Saul, and he came to the priest at Nob. I think this is in 1 Samuel chapter 21. Ahimelech, the priest at Nob, and he, of course, was hungry, and there was no common bread there.
Now, Saul is chasing him, right?
Saul is chasing
him,
right?
King Saul is after David. This is before David has become king.
Right, right. Okay. And he's, of course, trying to murder him if he possibly can. And he deceives this priest at Nob, Ahimelech, by saying that he had to leave quickly on this errand of Saul's, and he didn't have time to bring food or clothing, a change of clothing, or anything with him, including a sword. And this is when, of course, he ate the showbread. He and his men ate the showbread, and he wondered if there was...
This is normally not to be done,
no,
right?
No,
but the priest does this, gives them the bread, because it's an emergency situation.
Yeah, it's sort of vital for his life and the lives of his people. He said, you can do this. If the men have kept themselves from women, it says, I don't know how to necessarily interpret that, but that is one of the restrictions that evidently attended to the eating of that bread. If your men have kept themselves from women, which David assured Ahimelech that they had, then he gave them the showbread. And he asked for a sword, and he got Goliath's sword too, which is really not unimportant in this whole issue that's going to occur. We don't want to forget the Edomite here, because somebody is watching this whole transaction. And he's one of Herod's, what shall we say, herdsmen? And he sees it, and he reports to Saul, Doeg the Edomite, it says. He reports to Saul. Saul goes to Nob and wipes out 85 priests in this instance. One escapes, Abiathar, the one son escapes. And but it is an Edomite here who does turn in Ahimelech. Now, Ahimelech had been deceived by David, who simply gave an excuse that he was on an errand of Saul's, and he just simply didn't have time. And that's the excuse and the justification for doing what he did that Ahimelech tried to give to Saul. Saul would have none of it. He just simply had them wiped out. He couldn't get any of his own men to do it. They were honorable men, Saul couldn't. But Doeg, the Edomite, chose to do it, and he's the one who carried out Saul's order.
Huh. Now, I remember that name, Doeg, but I didn't realize that he was an Edomite.
That's Doeg the Edomite, yeah. And so it is, it's interesting that he would violate the priest, knowing, I assume he would know what that priest represented in Israel and all the priests, but he chose to carry out the order.
Although
anyway,
because he was not an Israelite, he probably felt that he could do this with, well, he didn't have the compunction, the restrictions that the others would have.
No, he wouldn't. He really wouldn't follow any sort of spiritual, religious, impulses under these circumstances. I don't think that would have an effect on him. The king gave me an order, I'll carry it out. I don't care who they are. They don't mean anything to me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, okay, that does really take us to the end of a very interesting part of the history of these patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and now...
So we're going to go into the story about Joseph at this point?
Joseph.
Well, before we do, let's take a break for a moment.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll be back in just a moment to continue this discussion of Christ in Every Word and what's happening now in the life of Joseph, who is the 11th son of Jacob. In the meantime, I want you to consider this question. What is the most valuable element in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence isn't enough without development in vocation. And what is vocation? You see, we believe God works through our vocations, our callings, those careers and roles we are educated to fulfill in order to meet the needs of our neighbor. The mission statement of Concordia puts it this way. Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 60 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website www.cuw.edu. Now, if you're benefiting from Christ in Every Word, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and offering your monetary support. Concordia graciously houses the Institute, but is unable to support the operational functions. You can support Christ in Every Word by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and click on the Contribute page. You'll find several ways in which you can support the message of Christ in Every Word. And if you've been listening to these podcasts over the last several years, you'll have noticed that the music is unavailable again today when we have our introduction and when we go through our interlude here during the middle of the presentation. And again, we have a few technical difficulties that we're working on, and not wanting to risk losing what we have already been able to record today, we're not going to attempt putting any music into this particular program. I hope you don't mind. I also want to let you know that coming up here, if you're in the area, that our second annual Hymn Fest is going to take place on October the 7th. That's a Sunday. It's going to start at 3:30 in the Chapel of Christ Triumphant here at Concordia University. And you're more than welcome to come and join us and sing with us favorite hymns. You'll have the opportunity to choose some of the hymns that we'll sing during the Hymn Fest. It'll be a wonderful time. Last year's was enjoyed by nearly 150 people who came for that event in our chapel, and certainly would hope to see you there if you're at all in the area. And now, let's get back to what's happening in Genesis. We have just taken ourselves through, under John's guidance, Dr. Seleska's guidance, chapter 36 of Genesis, dealing with Esau's descendants, that whole family, and how we find those descendants continually throughout the rest of the Old Testament on into King Herod himself. Now, we're moving into chapter 37, and we'll be talking about what happens in the Joseph cycle. Would we call it that?
I guess we can, because this man is singled out from all the others, and really the rest of the book of Genesis is, for the most part, about him in relationship to his brother and his father and so forth, but he really is the main character from now on.
Okay, well, so we're starting the story of Joseph and everything that follows out of his life.
Right, it talks about Jacob and Joseph immediately, and then it says this interesting thing. These are the generations of. Now, in the Hebrew, that's an interesting word, elet toledoth. It comes from that word, yalad, generations. But the idea in that word needs to be expanded on, because it's almost as if, okay, up to this point we have all of this information. It's preliminary to what's going to happen. Or we might say it this way. These remarkable events which have been portrayed for us in the scriptures give birth to that yalad idea, give birth to some even more astonishing results. You could say it's something like that. Or the preceding, the foregoing, contains the seed of what's going to follow. If you're telling a story, you would say, there are going to be, from all that we've given you, some very, very interesting developments. And really, this does get to be an interesting story, one of the most fascinating and poignant stories in the entire Old Testament. And it is clearly, I think you would have to say, a shadow of Christ. Now, Joseph is not going to be the messianic seed, but at the same time, this is really a picture of Christ here, if ever there was one, in what happens in Joseph's life. He could say, if we might summarize it, something like this before we go into all the details, and there are plenty here, and there are very interesting details. Joseph, as he reveals himself to his brothers, I'm Joseph, the beloved son, your brother, brought back from the dark prison. Luther, by the way, calls that prison in Egypt hell. Brought back from the dark prison hell alive. And I've been given the kingdom, and I can take care of any eventuality that might occur in your life. You see a picture of Christ in that picture of Joseph in the Old Testament. So clearly, I think the Holy Spirit is telling us something about what to expect when the Messiah comes. I might also add this before. I'm sure you have a question or two, but let me just say this. There are Psalms, particularly Psalm 104, in which Joseph, there are just little snippets, but I think you can expand on those little snippets to include a lot about Joseph that isn't detailed in these chapters in Genesis. Because it says about him, now you think about this for a moment from God's perspective and what God is doing here, because I don't think any of us, I'm sure none of us, would ever predict that this little lad being dragged behind camels into a foreign land and among people whose language he didn't know, that eventually he would be delivered from prison and given charge of everything in the land. I mean, how impossible is that to conceive of? And yet it's going to happen here to this little lad, this Jewish lad.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that I was going to mention, is that already in verse 2 it says, Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. So he's a teenager.
Yeah, he's a teenager. And it says in that psalm, then, Psalm 105, I think verse 17 says, He sort of sent a leader before them. Now, God really chose to send Joseph. And if you ask Joseph, would you mind going to Egypt? I'm sure he said, are you serious?
Well, yeah, it says, and he sent a man ahead of them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave.
Yeah, sold as a servant.
His feet were hurt with fetters, his neck was put in a collar of iron, until what he had said came to pass. And the word of the Lord tested him.
Yeah. The King James says it like this, until the word came, the word of the Lord tried him. In other words, can you believe, Joseph, that this is really going to turn out okay for you? He's really molding in a prison. He doesn't understand because he's there as an innocent person. How can God be permitting this to happen? And we all think that, I think, when affliction comes, how can God permit this to happen? But we have to remember that passage in Romans 8. All things, in fact, do work together for good, although it doesn't seem that way, I'm sure, to Joseph at this point.
No, he's the victim of a severe, severely dysfunctional family, tremendous sibling abuse.
Yes.
I mean, they throw him in a well. They actually are not, they're actually thinking of killing him at that point, aren't they?
Yes, they were going to.
They don't like this kid. What had he done to get such ire out of his siblings?
We'll investigate some of that, but two of those verses yet in Psalm 105, where it says, I think verse 19 and 20, somewhere in there, where it says, so the king called him, the king sent for him and had him released from prison, and then he says he gave him charge over all his household, and he, to put people in prison at his pleasure, to make teach his senators wisdom, is how the King James says it. He's put in charge of the whole penal system and the whole educational system. Well, if he's put in charge of the educational system, who do you think was front and center of the education in Egypt at that time? I don't have any doubt that somehow Jehovah and all the promises that Joseph knew were part of the educational system. Now, those are just little snippets, but I think you can conclude that, because when you realize that he was in charge of it all, everything in Pharaoh's household, this to us just boggles the mind. And yet, this little Jewish lad, there he is. But he had to learn a lot, and God needed to teach him.
Yeah. Now, we're going to be looking at those lessons in detail as we go through these upcoming chapters, aren't we?
We will. We are.
And, yes.
And don't forget to tune in, because you will be amazed at what's going to happen.
Okay. First problem that Joseph has, he's got too many dreams.
Well, first of all, it says his father loved him more than the others.
Oh, okay. Even before he gets the dreams.
Yeah. That's not good.
Okay.
That's a dysfunctional family, as yes. you indicated. His father loved him more than the others, and he gave him this coat of many colors.
Of course, why? Why did he love him more?
He was, shall we put it like, what is it in 1 John? 1 John 3 talks about Cain and Abel. It says, why did Cain slay Abel? Because his deeds were wicked, and his brothers were righteous. Now, here is this kid. He's righteous. He stands out from all the others. He really is, quotes, pious and God-fearing, and Jacob realized this. So it stands to reason, doesn't it, that he would love him more.
Okay.
Well, the Heavenly Father loves his son more, too, he says, and Jesus says, you know.
But he's also the son of Rachel.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, the firstborn son of Rachel.
The one that he really loves, I guess, even though he was a little idolatrous. He just couldn't take his eyes off her. She bewitched him, and sometimes that happens.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. And with Christ too, he says, "Why does the world hate me? Why does the world hate me? Because I testify of it that its works are evil. That's why they hate me." And so his brothers hated him.
Yeah.
Why? He's so good.
Yeah. In verse 3 of chapter 37, it says, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was the son of his old age."
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, doesn't that make sense too?
Well, it builds on the whole thing.
Yeah.
He's the youngest. He's the son of Rachel.
And he's really a good kid.
And he's a good kid. And he's the goody-goody in the family. And what could irritate all the other brothers more than that? And then he gets this robe
of
many
colors. Oh, yeah, it couldn't be worse.
Yeah.
So after all that, then after that verse 3, then in verse 4, the boys, the two sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher, he's keeping sheep with them, and he brings an evil report of these guys. These guys are doing what you wouldn't want them to do, Dad. He brings it back.
Okay,
you
so he's also
like
a tattletale.
Yeah.
Well,
he squealed on him.
Okay, if any of the younger persuasion are listening to this podcast, okay, here's some things not to do if you don't want your siblings to hate you.
Boy, well, you can imagine how they hated him already at that point. But then he has, like you say, these dreams. It couldn't be worse for Joseph when he has these dreams. Now, the first one, of course, is that dream. They're binding their sheaves in the field, and his sheaf arises, and their sheaves bow down to him. In a sense, I guess, revere him and reverence his sheaf. Well, you can imagine what they're thinking. You're going to rule over us? Do you think you're going to rule over us? I mean, what kind of thing is that to say to your brothers?
Especially when you're the youngest. Well, you've got the coat of many colors. That's why you can say that, because you're the favorite.
I know.
Yep.
I wonder, by the way, we didn't mention this when we talked about that coat of many colors, but why the coat of many colors? Was it some sort of a royal robe? And is Jacob thinking about who the Messiah is going to be from all these sons, which one? And you don't know. I'm sure we don't know whether or not he had, at this point at least, singled out Joseph. He seems to be the one to whom that blessing ought to be, on whom it should be spoken. I don't know if that's the case, but surely the robe of many colors, a royal robe, if that's what it was, and it does suggest that it was a lengthy one, long sleeves, and it reached all the way down to his feet, so it was a striking thing. And I'm sure it caught a lot of people's attention, including the other brothers. But I wonder if Jacob isn't somehow trying to determine, to weed out from the others, the one that should have that blessing spoken over him. And at this point, it would seem, at least to anybody, and to us concluded, that that this should be the one. The one is finally, the one that's finally chosen, we won't mention it here, seems to be one who should not have been chosen. And yet,
God he's the one.
Very unlikely people.
Yes, yes. Well, one more dream, and then we're going to have to call it quits for today.
Yeah. Well, the second one is about the same, the stars, 11 stars, and the sun and the moon.
So who do the sun and moon represent? Now we got 11 stars. That's pretty easy to figure out. That's got to be the brothers.
That's the brothers. And so he tells that to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebukes him, it says. His father was not happy with that. Are we... Now, your mother and I and your brothers going to bow down to you? And he rebukes him. But it also says his brothers were jealous. In this instance, it says they were jealous, envious of him. But his father observed him. That is, like with Mary, I guess, pondered in her heart. What does this mean? In other words, maybe to him again, this bowing down has got to mean something.
Something's going on here.
Yeah.
And Jacob doesn't know what it is.
No.
And he's not going to find out for many, many years.
Oh, sad years.
Sad years.
Very sad years.
Yep, because a tragedy is about to happen, and we're going to talk about that in our next podcast.
Very good.
To which we invite you to participate. Again, it'll be on iTunes, or you can get it at our website, www.concordiabible.org. We encourage you to continue to listen to Christ in Every Word and to support this ministry as you may be able. Check out on our website how you might be able to do that by clicking on the contribute page. So, this is all that we have time for today. Very interesting stories
coming
from the Old Testament.
Coming up, more interesting stories.
More interesting stories. And until we are able to be together again, God's blessings be yours.